word that can only understand force. So how about a force armed with the mother of all rights, the right to liberate Palestine from the river to the sea? Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Israelis are paranoid from the return of the resistance bombings, which had been absent for more than 15 years, but returned to occupied Al-Quds last Wednesday with the implementation of the Al-Quds operation. For many years, Palestinians attacked Israeli occupation forces targets with stabbing, run over, sometimes shootings, and stone throwing operations in response to the Israeli occupation aggressions and human rights violations. But the most effective of all to this moment was the scenes at the bombing sites of the bus stations in the heart of the occupied commercial centers where illegal colonial settlers roam, terrorizing native Palestinians. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, analyst in criminal justice and human rights. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nashabi. Now, the current atmosphere is very tense. The extremist right-wing Zionist voices are rising, and there are also Palestinians calling to escalate operations against the occupation. And this is reflected in the political atmosphere in general. What do you think the effect of such resistance operations, the like of Al-Quds operation, will be on the security of the Zionist forces and the morality of the illegal colonial settlers?
Yes. Well, let's first put things in context. The Israelis have been building and expanding settlements, disregarding any calls to stop this because it's a violation of international law. The expansionist nature of Zionism has been, ongoing. I mean, the European Union, the United Nations have put pressure on the Israelis to stop and to limit their expansion and limit the illegal settlements in the West Bank. But this did not compel the Israelis to stop. The Palestinians are left with no other choice but to continue their armed struggle, their resistance against Israeli continuous violation of international law and of the basic rights of the Palestinian people. This resistance is a clear message. The recent operations are a clear message that there will be no stability, there will be no peace, no stability as the Israelis continue to build these settlements. And the effect is huge because the effect is that no matter, I mean, this has been going on for so many years, and it will go on for the future, the foreseen future. The Palestinian people will continue to resist this Israeli violent aggression against them and against their basic rights. And that's creating a lot of instability also inside among the Zionists themselves, who are confused on how to react. They want to react violently, but they know that if they react violently, this will not lead to any good outcome for them. This will not stop the resistance. The resistance is going to continue, and it's getting stronger and stronger.
Well, this matter is not considered a huge development only because the operation took place in occupied Al-Quds Square, but also because the operation was carried out with explosive devices detonated from a distance or probably using a stopwatch. This has several implications. I mean, the most important of which is that the resistance in the West Bank now seemingly has the technical and practical capabilities to manufacture such explosive devices. And we've seen how the Lion's Den and other factions of resistance are now just popping up all across the West Bank to resist the occupation. How do you think this development will play out in the event that the Israelis decide to retaliate against the West Bank with a probable incursion?
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, the Palestinians have been resisting Israeli violations and Israeli aggression for so many years. So they accumulated experience, they accumulated know-how. They have developed their skills, and they are getting support from nations who support the resistance. I mean, and parties who support the resistance across the border. Now, the intelligence has been developed. Of course, it's not just technology; it's intelligence capacity. It's not just the technology of actually, starting an explosive device from a distance. Also, the intelligence for gathering sufficient information to choose the target, to see where, how to target. And also, I think the explosive material is also becoming more efficient. And this is a very, very interesting development, especially inside the West Bank. And, inside the West Bank, there are so many various and different factions among the Palestinians. They are working together. So this is also creating an internal unity among the Palestinians to be able to achieve these operations. And lastly, also the Palestinians have developed this knowledge of how the Israelis function and how they actually gather information about the resistance, and they're able to block them. So this accumulation of experience and knowledge is making the resistance more efficient and actually is targeting more accurately the objectives among the Zionists. And the last operation showed this, and there are hopefully in the future the Palestinian people will continue with these operations and will show even more advanced skills.
What was very interesting was that they were capable of actually maneuvering around the security perimeter of the Zionist entity, especially in a city like the occupied Al-Quds, where
exactly.
Bickering has been forever over whether it is the capital of Palestine or not. Well, we know it is, but the Zionist entity doesn't accept that. How do you think that the security apparatus of the Zionist entity will deal with this breach?
Well, I think they are confused. I don't think that the Israeli security apparatus is being able to handle this situation. They are going through a lot of internal tensions. They don't know how to react. On one hand, there is a current inside among the Israeli enemy that calls for a kind of appeasement and a kind of naturalization of relations with some Gulf countries and Arab countries. On the other side, they are becoming more aggressive. They are lost on how to actually create a balance between these two lines of policy. And that's creating a lot of confusion among the Israelis themselves, whereas mm-hmm. the solution is very simple, is to give the Palestinians their basic rights, as the UN and the European Union have been actually saying for so many years. Stop the settlements. The settlements are continue to grow in the West Bank, and that is something that is creating a lot of tension and will create more violence and more instability in the future.
We did hear that the enemy's security assessment have been conflicting about have been issuing conflicting reports about the responsibility of those behind the Al-Quds operation. We had, according to Zionist Channel 7 website, some security assessments indicate that a man from Al-Quds brigades funded by Hamas is responsible. And then we heard from Yari'ot Ahranot, newspaper reported that whoever carried out the bombings acted without external guidance, meaning that he is actually from within the West Bank. Does it make any difference if the West Bank's lines then were behind it, or maybe the resistance factions in Gaza? What's the difference?
Well, it makes a difference. But in both cases, it's bad news for the Israelis. I mean, if this man has been acting alone, I mean, he's more mysterious, he's more unpredictable, more difficult to track, spontaneous, and therefore that cannot be beaten easily, especially for an intelligence apparatus. If that man has been supported by an organization, that shows how the organizational skills have developed. That means there is a collective kind of an planning, and this is also very bad news for the Israelis. In both cases, this shows that the resistance is ongoing and that there's nothing that will be able to stop it. Israel, that has some of the most advanced technologies in the world, is not able to stop a people asking for their basic rights. And if they're not going to get their basic rights in peaceful ways, they will get it with armed resistance, as the UN Charter, in fact, protects
the people who actually struggle for their rights. For that matter, I do have a solution for the Zionists. Just beat it, get out of Palestine,
exactly.
Liberate Palestine from the river to the sea. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Omar Nashabi, analyst in criminal justice and human rights, for being with us and sharing your insights about the Al-Quds operation. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking how Kurdish separatists in Syria and Iraq are under fire.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the Iranian and Russian positions on the renewed Turkish threat of ground military operations in Syria show a kind of softness that can be explained by a number of new circumstances, which made the three guarantors of the Astana talks intersect in their hostility to the Kurdish separatist forces in northern Syria. This softer approach by Iran and Russia was not until months ago, as it is today, when the Russians and Iranians recorded firmness regarding any Turkish operation of the above-mentioned type. In light of the semi-acceptance of Moscow and Tehran to the Turkish arguments and the trio contacts entering the stage of talking about the limits of the incursion and the political costs required to meet it, Kurdish separatists under fire in this following report.
Under the surface of the calm that the Syrian battlefield experienced throughout the previous months, many pressuring factors were working on more than one active site of the Astana talks, some of which seem to have reached the moment of explosion today. This applies, for example, to the air attacks carried out by Turkey against the Syrian Democratic Forces in northern Syria under the title of Operation Claw Sword, and hinting at the approaching moment of the ground operation during which the Turkish army will control more bordering Syrian land. This step has always been a point of discussion throughout the past period, especially in the Astana round of talks held last June and then again last week on November 23, which took place 2 days before the Turkish bombing of the SDF sites in full view of the Russian and American forces deployed in the region. And while Russia is still on its declared position rejecting the Turkish ground move, with the emergence of noticeable changes in the field in terms of allowing Turkish planes to penetrate Russian airspace inside Syria, Iran these days is showing greater understanding of this move. For Russia, the Russian-Turkish cooperation has reached its climax in recent months with the intensification of the Russian special operation in Ukraine, as Russia realizes that Turkey today is one of its main crossings to the world in light of the ongoing Western blockade on the former. As for Iran, which is dealing today with Western-instigated internal unrest, it accuses the Kurdish opposition party stationed in the Kurdistan region of northern Iraq of being responsible for sending, training, and equipping armed groups to carry out terrorist acts on Iran's soil. Iran responded quickly to this threat by targeting the sites of these parties, also hinting at the possibility of launching a ground military operation to remove them from its borders with Iraq. Hence, Turkish diplomats argue in front of their Iranian counterparts in the context of the formation of the new Iranian position towards the armed Kurdish parties, comparing it with the previous and current Turkish position, to say that their country's past and expected military operations in Syria are legitimate and justified. Met by this argument, Iranian officials show understanding of Turkish security concerns, but they did urge their Turkish counterparts to cooperate with the Syrian government to ensure the deployment of the Syrian army on the borders between the two countries in order to prevent Kurdish military operations inside Turkish territory. This is exactly what Tehran sought with Baghdad, the first fruits of which were evident in the Iraqi government's announcement of the deployment of its forces on the borders between Iran and the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Thus, it appears that the interest of the three guarantor countries of the Astana talks converges with hostility to the Kurdish separatist forces in northern Syria.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Mr. Aqil Hananu, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Aqil. Now, what made the three guarantors of the Astana talks intersect in their hostility to the Kurdish separatist forces in northern Syria?
I think this is the beginning of the end for the hostility going on in Syria. I think this is a message to the American more than the Kurds. The Kurds are tools used by the American. We never heard about the American caring about the Kurds or Syria or anybody before now. And the continuous support of the American to the Kurds for their aggression, for their stealing of the oils and the wheats of Syria. And then now the accusation of the bombing in Istanbul caused all this. At the same time, in Iran, the Kurds in Iran also start moving, trying to repeat the story of Syria, which consolidated the three alliance between Turkey, Iran, and Russia. And I guarantee you, what's going on in the northern part of Syria right now, it's happening with the complete approval of the Syrian government. Because at one point, the Turks asked the Syrian Arab Army to control the Kurds, and the Syrian government refused to participate in any war over there as long as the occupation forces of Turkey remain in there. So that forced the hand of Turkey to come and clear the area and as a sign of beginning to go to normalization between Syria and Turkey.
Well, Msaqil, under the surface of the calm that the Syrian battlefield has experienced, especially throughout the previous months, many pressure factors were working on more than one active party in the file of the Kurdish separatists, some of which seem to have reached a moment of explosion, as you mentioned when you started. However, wouldn't that just allow a reignition of dormant terrorist organizations in Syria, like, for example, al-Nusra or Daesh, in the event that Turkey actually gets inside of the Syrian territory?
Well, the Turkish are already inside the Syrian territories, and the Turkish are part of the protectors of Daesh and Nusra. Daesh and al-Nusra, they are not independent organizations where they could move as they wish. They wait for instruction, and they act on those instructions from their masters. So I don't think there will be any movement from Daesh or al-Nusra at this time, because the Turkish don't want to create another battle. They want to finish from the Kurd separatists in Syria, and then they will focus on al-Nusra and Daesh. And that battle is coming. It's not something is going to be put off for a long time. Once the Kurds get contained, the next target will be Idlib, where al-Nusra is based.
But what's the guarantee that the Kurds will be contained? I mean, we all watched 2 weeks ago the Istiklal bombing in the heart of Istanbul, and we still don't have answers if actually the Kurds had a hand in it or not. But what is the guarantee for Turkey that the Kurds of Syria will be contained?
Well, that's the guarantee. It's going to come from the United States. When you cut off the supply and the support of the American to the Kurds, they have no way but to go back to the bases and try to consolidate whatever problem they have with the Syrian government. I mean, the Russian has suggested that the Syrian army protect the border and for the Kurds to withdraw. But the Kurds refuse, and that's also according to the instruction they received from the American. So we are waiting to see, and I think those people are not going to be settled with peace negotiation, because any peace negotiation with them will give them legitimacy, which they should not have, because they do not have it. So the guarantee is going to come from their master. Mm-hmm. And what I see with the American are trying to position themselves to clear the area in the Middle East from any hostility so they could focus on China and Russia.
Well, we did see that Russia is still on its declared position, rejecting any Turkish incursion into Syria. But we did see some noticeable changes. For example, the Russians are now allowing the Turks to use the airspace that they protect over Syrian territory. And we did see also Iran these days showing greater understanding of any possible incursion by the Turks. Might we see a joint Turkish-Iranian attack against Kurdish pockets, both in northern Iraq and in northern Syria?
In Iraq, for Iran, I do anticipate some kind of movement, unless the Iraqi government comes and control the area there. But I do not anticipate to see any Iranian armed forces in Syria. Syrian army are capable, and the Syrian army has the same goal as the allies, Russia and Iran, in Syria. And the incursion of the Turkish into the space protected by Russia has been approved by the Syrian government for the goal of that intervention to end the separatist Kurds' presence in the northern part. So I don't see any military presence of the Iranian in Syria, be it airspace or ground.
Well, in less than a minute, can you tell me what the position of the Syrian government will be from all of that we mentioned?
Well, the Syrian government wants to liberate all its property and land. And that's the goal. Who does it doesn't matter. But whoever left standing after this, the Syrian army will take care of it. We will spread our authority over all the Syrian land. And listen, before all this Arab Spring or the revolution, democracy, none of Turkey or Iran had any problem with any Kurds or anybody, because the Syrian army was controlling their land. The Iraqi army was controlling their land. But when the American came with the presenting democracy and freedom as they see it into this part of the world, chaos erupted, and here we are now.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Aqil Hanan, a political commentator, joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, to talk about how the separatist Kurds, both in Syria and Iraq, will see the end of these days to come, especially at the beginning of next year. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you for being always part of our reports of telling the truth. Sanction us no matter how you see possible. We will never cease telling the truth. I'll see you again next week. Salam alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The British Medical Association, which has recently conducted studies on the healthcare system in the United Kingdom, has warned about the collapse of this system and has called for immediate government action. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British news provider Daily Telegraph has more details. Britain's top accident and emergency doctor says about 4,000 patients a day are spending more than 12 hours in the emergency department because the care system has collapsed. The British National Health Service, NHS, publishes monthly statistics on the number of accident and emergency patients forced to wait more than 12 hours after doctors chose to admit them to hospital. According to the latest published data, last October, 43,792 patients waited more than 12 hours in the emergency department just for a doctor to decide on admission to the ward, totaling 50% more than last year. An NHS spokesman said, urgent and emergency care services are facing considerable demand, with record levels of attendances at major accident and emergency departments last year, significant levels of COVID, and the highest ever number of the most serious ambulance call-outs this summer. That's in addition to difficulties discharging thousands of patients who are medically fit for discharge. The system failure that is being said to cause about 2,000 deaths per month as the access to emergency room becomes harder. The head of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, Dr. Adrian Boyle, issued a warning to the nurses who are planning their first national strike in history on 15th and 20th of December. The nurses will protest before Christmas, because of bad working conditions and low wages due to rising prices and the cost of living crisis. According to Dr. Adrian Boyle, more than 7 million people are waiting for non-urgent or elective treatment. Nurses are generally mostly needed, especially for the care of cancer patients, in helping them with their chemotherapy sessions, tests or transplant services. With the walkout, around 30,000 sessions and operations could be postponed. Dr. Adrian Boyle pointed out the overcrowded conditions of hospitals, the high number of wandering patients in the corridors of medical centres, and the amount of time it consumes to transfer patients from the ambulance to the emergency room. He touched on the arrival of winter and the spread of flu, warning against the escalation of the situation and signalling that the country's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse. He said, "We're very worried about what I would call British exceptionalism. There is avoidable mortality that is occurring pretty much only in Britain, which is related to the collapse of the emergency healthcare system. Data gathered by the Royal College of Emergency Medicine suggests the number of patients stuck on trolleys for more than 12 hours has risen by 50% in a year." Sally Warren, Director of Policy at the King's Fund think tank, said the health system is so stretched on all fronts that it is hard to arrest the deterioration in performance. The British government has resorted to reducing public welfare expenses, including in the healthcare sector, in order to reduce the budget deficit. The iNews website has more details. According to National Health Service data for England, in 2021-2022, almost a million people were forced to wait at least 12 hours in accident and emergency, three times higher than 3 years earlier. Analysis by the Royal College of Emergency Medicine suggests this figure could surge to 1.5 million this year, and there could be a 50% rise in cases in a year. According to National Health Service target, accident and emergency patients should be treated, admitted or discharged within 4 hours, but only 71% of people are being treated within this timescale. NHS England publishes monthly statistics on the number of accident and emergency patients forced to wait more than 12 hours after doctors chose to admit them to hospital. But the Royal College of Emergency Medicine claims these cases are the tip of the iceberg because they do not account for time spent waiting before the decision is taken. Latest data has revealed 43,792 people waited longer than 12 hours in October, a rise from 32,776 in September and 19,053 in May. A Department of Health and Social Care spokesman said, "No one should have to wait longer than necessary to access urgent and emergency care, which is why we are working with the NHS to take action to ease pressure across the system and prepare more extensively for winter than ever before." A shortage of about 1,800 full-time general practitioners, local family doctors, has led to difficulties in booking doctors' appointments and forced more people to seek treatment at hospital emergency departments. Most of the criticism has been levelled at politicians, but failings in the day-to-day running of the service has also been exposed. Serious failures have been found in some maternity wards that contributed to the deaths of babies who could have survived had they had better care. Healthcare specialists warned that the problems had no short-term solution and that the United Kingdom should emulate countries such as Denmark and Sweden and ditch the market-driven approach to healthcare. The Medical Express website has more details for us. With record waiting times, staff shortages, financial black holes, and now a nurses' strike over pay, The United Kingdom's state-run National Health Service, NHS, is facing an unprecedented crisis. The walkout by nurses next month heaps fresh misery on the institution, just as winter illnesses bite and as the country faces a prolonged recession. Matthew Taylor, head of the NHS Confederation, which represents the service in England and Wales, said demand for frontline care is skyrocketing. Matthew Taylor added, waiting time standards are deteriorating despite the sterling effort of NHS staff, and the winter months look to be very bleak and the busiest on record. A record 7.1 million people are waiting for treatment, with long delays for tests as well as routine and emergency care. Richard Sullivan, a cancer care specialist, said some 14,000 prostate cancer cases were missing due to a lack of diagnosis, with around 1 in 18 waiting more than a year. He added, "You shut down your healthcare system, you're going to lead to a massive number of people with stage shifts, where their cancers become more advanced. Difficulty in replacing departing staff has deepened the crisis. Record inflation has led to gloomy forecasts of a prolonged recession and cuts to public spending, potentially extending the crisis." Richard Sullivan, Professor of Cancer Policy and Global Health at King's College London, said, "The NHS was burning hot for years, even before COVID placed extra burdens. As well as denting public finances, inflation has caused a wider cost of living crisis that has led to a large-scale industrial action across multiple sectors." The Royal College of Nursing says nurses' wages have fallen sharply in real terms in recent years. Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
For thousands of years, the merchants, voyagers, and caravans traveling on the Silk Road used Iran or ancient Persia as a transit hub. The country played a significant role in transporting commodities from west to east and vice versa. Ancient Persia, with its numerous bazaars and caravanserais, was one of the main trade stations along the ancient Silk Road due to its geopolitical position. In recent times, this huge capacity, nonetheless, became stagnant due to war, political conflicts and sanctions, and consequently lack of infrastructure. However, the current international conditions have presented Iran with a terrific opportunity to play a significant role in the broader implementation of the international North-South Transport Corridor and the Road and Belt Project, and hence transform into a regional trade hub by developing its transit infrastructure. Given the lower costs and shorter time of trade by using its transit corridors, Iran can become the main trade link between Asia and Europe once again, and in the process effectively neutralize the US attempts to isolate the Islamic Republic from the global economy. In fact, Iran's transit potential is proving so attractive that it is among the driving forces behind recent regional diplomacy. Experts believe that economic interdependencies provided by such regional cooperation can establish a measure of rationality and efficiency and perhaps create incentives for peace between long-time adversaries in West Asia. To take a closer look at these potential developments, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. We'll be right back. A few months ago, a pair of trucks from the northernmost United Arab Emirates Princeton of Ras Al Khaimah made their way south to the port at Sharjah. The drivers eased them onto a specialized roll-on, roll-off ferry that crossed the Persian Gulf to the Iranian port of Bandar Abbas, where they disembarked at the Shahid Bahonar terminal and made a beeline for Iran's fine multi-lane highways. They headed northwest across Iran to the mountainous frontier with Turkey. Then, upon crossing the Bazargan border, the drivers headed southwest to the Turkish Mediterranean seaport of Mersin. Thus, a new trade route was established, one that regional actors are jumping on and could build the kind of trade ties that encourage peaceful relations in West Asia.
Nowadays, the West Asia region, especially Iran's geography, is approximately located at the crossing of north-south and east-west junctions of the world, and is considered as the connecting point of the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe. This very attribute has given Iran's geography a unique political characteristic, as well as the identity, capacity, and the opportunity of geo-economic character. So if this is used properly, it can bring Iran great economic security and political outcomes.
International experts indicate that the Iran route makes a lot of sense. In all, the trip from the UAE to the Mediterranean takes a mere 6 days, according to the World Road Transport Organization, IRU. That's a fraction of the 21 days or so it would take to get a shipment from the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea through the bottleneck at the Suez Canal and into the Mediterranean Sea.
In terms of infrastructure, we have a high capacity and high quality infrastructure. I mean, Iran's transit network connecting surrounding geography and civilizations to other parts of the world. I believe that our transit routes are of high quality and volume. For instance, wherever there is a shortage of railways, there are definitely high capacity roads. Or wherever there is a need for waterways entrance, definitely we have high capacity ports, be it either the northern shores of Caspian Sea or in the southern shores of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
Lawyers who specialize in international sanctions and trade law have commented that at the moment, the biggest historical abnormality is the absence of Iran from the global trading system. The development of this transit corridor makes a lot of sense historically and geographically, in that Iran would play this significant role.
You know that right now we have 12,000 kilometers of railway in the country and 6,000 kilometers of road networks. Of course, this is a huge network. 50 to 60% of our roads and the majority of our railways have transit capabilities. But to reach the 300 million ton target in the future, in effect, we need to develop our transport networks. I believe we need to act more rapidly in that direction in terms of infrastructure and equipment development.
Since the Iran trade route was opened, roughly 1,000 trucks have made the trip between Turkey and the UAE, mostly carrying goods from west to east, according to numbers provided by the local Turkish officials and media outlets. The products, which are worth millions of dollars in total, include consumer durables, foodstuff, cosmetics, machinery, spare parts, and personal belongings moving back and forth. Apparently, the trips are facilitated by a single set of $30 transit documents issued by the International Road Transport Organization, which are valid in dozens of Eurasian nations.
The current changing international environment has impacted the major international transit corridors or China's Belt and Road Project, either in energy or cargo fields, in a way that they have to depend on this critical strategic region. With the start of the Ukraine war and the challenges in South Caucasus from 2020 onwards, Iran's position has become very important due to the strategic security that its geography offers.
Based on the studies we've done, the crossing of any kind of transit commodity through roads creates about $150 of revenue for us, directly and indirectly.
meaning that it creates some revenues for the public sector and some for the private sector. It has benefits for the people of the regions that the transit commodity passes through. But in my opinion, aside from the mentioned value, the overall benefits of tying up business and economy to the geography of Iran in the mold of transit is priceless. And however much the interdependencies of regional and international merchants with Iran increases, we can expect our revenues and benefits help us reach our development targets.
Based on media reports, Pakistan is also taking advantage of a newly launched Iranian route to Turkey, which cuts travel times for goods between South Asia and Europe from upwards of 40 days by sea down to as little as a week. Additionally, Central Asian nations, worried about bottlenecks at Caspian Sea ports that have caused weeks of delays, as well as a war raging in Ukraine that has impeded Eurasian traffic, are looking to Iran to get goods back and forth.
The Azerbaijan issue is a different story. As you know, Azerbaijan has a strategic alliance with Turkey. In this alliance, they have attempted to impact the North-South corridor on the western part of our country. We've been witnessing a certain game that they're playing in terms of military and security issues, for instance, utilizing their leverage towards Armenia. Turkey is working a lot on these issues. On one hand, they come to negotiate, and on the other hand, they utilize the Azerbaijan card. They're doing all they can to impact the Astara to Bandar Abbas corridor and prevent it from full implementation. Well, we have other options, such as the routes that go through Armenia to the Caspian Sea. I believe Azerbaijan will eventually make peace with this issue. But for now, they're mostly functioning as a tool for Turkey. Or we can go beyond that and mention the fact that they allowed Israeli bases into their soil, trying to scare investors from investing in Iran. But the Islamic Republic can naturally do its own countermeasures in order to protect its national interests.
Commercially, the use of Iran as a land route makes complete sense. A global container shortage has upped the cost of sea freight, and the threat of piracy or terrorism at sea has jacked up insurance rates. A land option roughly coinciding with the ancient Silk Road connecting Asia to Europe reduces transit times, lowers insurance and refrigeration costs, eases other transport bottlenecks, and could alleviate supply chain shortages, benefiting businesses and consumers worldwide.
We have an extensive cooperation with Azerbaijan Republic. We share east-west and also the north-south transit corridors, meaning that the western route of the north-south through Caspian Sea is shared with Azerbaijan. Also, the connection of Nakhchivan and mainland Azerbaijan is through the Iranian territory. So, we have common benefits in the mentioned corridors. But we also have competition in certain aspects, especially in the route that crosses the Caspian Sea. I don't call it anything but competition. We are competing on alternative routes.
Other land options are less feasible. Currently, Iraq bars transit transportation within its borders and huge areas of Syria remain unstable and in a state of armed conflict. That leaves Iran without any feasible competition.
The fact that other countries are trying to reduce our share of transit is just competition. There's a political dimension and an economic one in it. If we want to analyze the competitive aspect, we have the natural advantage. But if we want to advance our competitive advantage in terms of higher volumes and reaching our goals, we need to develop our infrastructure and the related management systems. And for this development, we need investments.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Further economic integration with Iran, while a boost for business, will likely neutralize ongoing attempts by the United States to keep the Islamic Republic isolated. However, there is evidence that at least in this case, regional nations are choosing to ignore American preferences. Having said that, Iranian transport officials say that there are still many kinks to iron out. There is plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Here is how it looks on the page. Tehran Times reads, oil ship affiliated with Israeli billionaire hit by drone off Oman coast. Under the condition of anonymity, a West Asian defense official told the Associated Press that a drone carrying a bomb had attacked the oil ship Tuesday night off the coast of Oman. The official recognized the ship as Pacific Zircon, as an oil tanker owned by Eastern Pacific Shipping, bearing the Liberian flag. The Singapore-based corporation is owned by Israeli billionaire Eden Ofer. A commercial vessel was involved in an incident in the Gulf of Oman, the Fifth Fleet of the U.S. Navy informed Reuters. The attack has not yet been attributed to anyone. The Geopolitics asks, can Iran counter its rivals in Central Asia through connectivity push? Iran has rapidly emerged as a major transport hub. Iran's strategic location as a connecting link between West Asia and South Asia gives its distinct leverage. Iran is trying to bank on this advantage and push for greater engagements with Central Asia. Iran lacks economic heft of its rivals. However, connectivity initiatives may give Iran an edge over its rivals in Central Asia. With transit routes and supply lines disrupted due to the Russia-Ukraine war, Iran's position as a connectivity point to South Asia, Middle East, Africa, and Southeast Asia could be a pivot with the landlocked Central Asian countries. The global economic power center shifting to Asia, Iran offers an attractive outreach to the Central Asian countries, to South Asia, particularly to India. With Russia's eroding influence, Central Asian countries would seek to diversify their external engagements. Iran's proposition as a gateway to South and Southeast Asia could lead to Central Asian countries strengthening their ties with Iran. Iran's role in trade and transit has increased considerably over recent years. In 2021, the country's overall transit traffic rose by 68%, while transit traffic by road doubled. Transit is forecasted to grow by another 25% by the end of 2022.
Today, the economy is the top issue. If you can provide a secure, short and economic route for your neighbors, either the immediate neighbors or beyond them, they will definitely choose your lands to cross. This will bring you the opportunity that other countries' economies will be tied up and dependent on yours. And as a result, you are no longer alone on the international stage.
In light of Iran's growing role in regional trade, the International Road Transport Union, IRU, and Iran's private and public sectors have held high-level talks recently on avenues for further expansion. IRU Secretary General Umberto de Preto traveled to Iran a few months back to discuss how the country can continue along this positive trade and transit trajectory. He held a series of high-level talks, including meetings with the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Customs Authorities, and IRU member, Iran Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines, and Agriculture. The authorities and IRU expressed their satisfaction with how they have cooperated and successfully implemented joint projects to further improve east-west and north-south corridors crossing Iran. IRU Secretary General Umberto de Preto said, "The growth of Iran's transport sector in recent years has been impressive, making it the number one issuer of TIR car nets in 2021. The TIR Carnet allows road transport of goods in transit between member countries of the TIR Convention. It facilitates the circulation of goods under duties and taxes suspension by simplifying the customs procedures.
The Chabahar part of the North-South corridor is very critical and very strategic to the point that Central Asian countries are very insistent about it. Incidentally, the president of Kazakhstan in his recent meeting with President Raisi repeatedly inquired about the development of the Sarakhs-Chabahar railway project because Central Asia needs to have access to the warm waters of the Indian Ocean.
IRU Secretary General also stated that Turkmenistan's recent opening of its borders will now connect China to Turkey and Europe via Iran, making the southern corridor a viable alternative to the northern one.
In my opinion, the China Beltway is a plan that seeks to intertwine China's development to other countries' development beyond its western borders, meaning that it will push business, economic, and maybe even security borders of China towards the west. Accordingly, however much we can interconnect our own development with China's, I believe our role in Beltway plan increases. I mean, we should make the grounds for cooperation in a way that Iran's development become linked with China's. Experience shows that China, especially in the Beltway innovation, has gone to places that environmental challenges are at the lowest. I think we can define a very good cooperation with China, although in terms of Belt and Road Initiative, the defined routes have always included Iran. In light of that, we can say we've been able to get a share of the east-west transit corridors.
IRU officials and Iranian public and private actors also emphasized the benefits of using digital trade tools such as those with the TIR system and the CMR Convention. The CMR Convention is a United Nations convention that relates to various legal issues concerning transportation of cargo by road. There was equally a strong interest expressed by the Transport Ministry to partner with IRU to further improve the professional competence of drivers and road transport managers through IRU training and certification programs.
Let me tell you a historical point briefly. The existence of many caravanserais in the geography of our dear Iran is indicative of the fact that we've had a transit role throughout the history. This means that Iran has always been the shortest, most secure, and most economical route for merchants. You can find caravanserais in every corner of the country that were chosen by merchants from other countries.
Meanwhile, the row between Europe and Russia over the Ukraine war, which resulted in harsh sanctions being imposed on the country, cornered the Russian government economically, and many European countries closed their borders on Russian goods, making it very hard for its traders to be able to access their destination markets. As a result, the country started looking for new ways for distributing its goods across the world, especially in Asia and the International North-South Transit Corridor, INSTC, once again came under the spotlight.
Today we are in a position that the world is experiencing changes. Governments are not waiting to get the approval of bigger powers like America anymore. The changing of times has provided the opportunity for countries to take care of their own needs directly and through a network order. Today, the disaster that is happening to Europe in terms of energy is because the Europeans insist on their traditional line of thought to follow the American order and things.
The agreement for launching INSTC was signed by Iran, India and Russia back in 2000. However, despite all the interest and hype, the attention to the route faded in time due to geopolitical hurdles, including the global economic stagnation, the US sanctions on Iran, the conflict in Karabakh, and the pandemic. Now, the multimodal network of ships, rail, and roads is once again gaining its importance as the most important trade link between Asia and Europe.
on transit corridors due to potential benefits and added value for other countries, they would be willing to make investments. In fact, we have the potential for this scenario, but we need to decisively and quickly make our own plans for it, so that our competition won't get ahead of us in taking possession of our market share.
According to official data, one of the major advantages of this transportation route is that the cost of transporting goods through this corridor is 30% cheaper. For instance, it halves the time it takes to transport Indian goods to Russia. If one can use this transit route to distribute European commodities in the shortest possible time and at a lower cost than other routes to the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf. It is predicted that after the full operation of INSTC, Iran will be able to earn $20 billion in transit profits annually, something helping it reduce its dependence on oil revenues amid the American unfair and illegal sanctions on the sector.
In my opinion, the weaknesses we can mention are beyond the structural issues. They are rather related to process topics, such as the conflict of interests that might happen in decision-making process or impacts of the structure of our financial order when we want to control one part of our financial system, and that creates a limitation in another part of the system. As such, the transit sector works the same way. These types of limitations can be called the bottleneck of our transportation system.
The Islamic Republic has been taking serious measures for the development of its railway network, as well as its ports and shipping infrastructure, in order to encourage more countries to join the project.
We have a good amount of liquidity in the country. Considering the high rate of return that transit projects offer, we can issue bonds and provide the needed investment in these projects. But we can also create project funding and take care of financing this way. So these are some of the domestic methods available to us besides foreign investment. In terms of foreign investment, Foreign Ministry and the government are currently negotiating with Russia and some Eurasian countries. Implementation of some projects are imminent, and we're looking forward to them.
Besides linking India to Europe via this corridor, Iran can connect Central Asia to the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf. Landlocked countries in Central Asia can use the corridor's railway to access the high seas. Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Turkey, Iraq, and Afghanistan have also shown interest in joining the huge project by linking their railways to that of Iran. Earlier this month, Kazakhstan reached an agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran for using the country's rail network and the southern Shahid Rajai port for transiting goods to the Central Asian and Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, regions. That's all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same time next week and each week after. And don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our weekly episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the